Well, good morning, everybody. Good morning and welcome to Essex Church, where this, our gathered community of Kensington Unitarians, meets each week for worship. Two special welcomes this morning. Firstly, welcoming anybody who may be listening to this service sometime in the future when it goes out as a podcast on our church website. In our current newsletter, there's a lovely piece written by one-time member Mark who describes the way he still connects with this community via the podcasts. And I've also heard from Joan and David and Paul that they are regular and appreciative listeners. So welcome to them. Thank you for letting us know that you're joining us. And my second special welcome this morning goes to the Reverend Frank Walker and his family. Frank is Minister Emeritus of our Cambridge congregation and is going to be our preacher here today. And he's going to show us how it's done proper. And after all those welcomes, let's take a moment now to settle ourselves. Here and now, in this building, with these people at this time. As a Unitarian congregation, we welcome everyone to join us, whoever you are, however you are, whatever you are or whatever you are not. There is a place here for you in this worshipping community. Here we can be who we truly are. We do not have to keep up appearances or attempt to be anything other than ourselves. We may feel flawed or broken, weary or agitated, self-satisfied or confused. Whatever our present experience on the great spectrum of human life, it's okay to be here now in company with one another, in company with that which we hold to be divine. Welcome, everyone. Our chalice is lit. Its small flame, a reminder of communities the world over that are committed as we are to the cause of religious freedom. We've got two readings now, and this first one is very brief, and it perfectly sums up my own human condition. I wonder if it speaks to yours, the way that I can go through probably most of the days of my life wondering why on earth I've just said that or done that or not done this or what on earth is going on. So this is from Paul's letter to the Romans from chapter 7. I do not understand my own actions, for what I do is not what I desire to do, but rather what I hate. I have the will, but not the power to do good. And the good which I would do, I do not. But the evil which I would not do, that I do. Oh, wretched one that I am, who shall deliver me? And Anthony's going to deliver me by delivering some words from the bard himself. Famous, famous words.
Shakespeare, so you can all have a quick rest. This is from the Seven Ages of Man speech from As You Like It. All the world's a stage, and all the men and women merely players. They have their exits and their entrances. And one man in his time plays many parts, his acts being seven ages. At first, the infant, mewling and puking in his nurse's arms, and then the whining schoolboy with his satchel and shining morning face, creeping like a snail unwillingly to school, and then the lover, sighing like a furnace with a woeful ballad made to his mistress' eyebrow. Then the soldier, full of strange oaths and bearded like the pard jealous in honour, sudden and quick in quarrel, seeking the bubble reputation even in the cannon's mouth, and then the justice, with fair round belly, with good capon lined, with eye severe and beard of formal cut, full of wise saws and modern instances, and so he plays his part. The sixth age shifts into the lean and slippered pantaloon, with spectacles on nose and pouch on side, his useful hose well saved, a world too wide for his shrunk shank, and his big manly voice turning again towards childish treble, pipes and whistles in his sound. Last scene of all that ends this strange and eventful history is second childishness and mere oblivion. Sans teeth, sans eyes, sans taste, sans
a parable written by the late Alan Watts. He used to say it's a story that he told. He used to tell to children to give them an idea of what the world was like. Not exactly, but more or less something like the world is. And of course, the ideas come from the ancient teachings of Indian religion. There never was a time when the world began, because it goes round and round like a circle, and there's no place on a circle where it begins. Look at my watch, which tells the time. It goes round, and so the world repeats itself again and again. But just as the hour hand of the watch goes up to 12 and down to 6, so too there's day and night, waking and sleeping, living and dying, summer and winter. You can't have any one of these without the other, because you wouldn't be able to know what black is unless you've seen it side by side with white, or white unless side by side with black. In the same way, there are times when the world is and times when it isn't. For if the world went on and on without rest forever and ever, it would get horribly tired of itself. It comes and it goes. Now you see it, now you don't. So because it doesn't get tired of itself, it always comes back again after it disappears. It's like your breath. It goes in and out, and if you try to hold it in all the time, you feel terrible. It's also like the game of hide and seek, because it's always fun to find new ways of hiding and to seek for someone who doesn't always hide in the same place. God also likes to play hide and seek, but because there's nothing outside God, he has no one but himself to play the game with. But he gets over this difficulty by pretending that he's not himself. This is his way of hiding from himself. He pretends that he is you and I and all the people in the world, all the animals, all the plants, all the rocks and all the stars. In this way he has a strange and wonderful adventures, some of which are terrible and frightening, but these are just like bad dreams, for when he wakes up, they will disappear. Now, when God plays hide and seek and pretends that he is you and I, he does it so well that it takes him a long time to remember where and how he hid himself. But that's the whole fun of it, just what he wanted to do. He doesn't want to find himself too quickly, for that would spoil the game. That's why it's so difficult for you and me to find out that we are God in disguise, pretending not to be himself. But when the game has gone on long enough, all of us will wake up, stop pretending, and remember that we are all one single self, the God who is all that there is and who lives forever and ever. Of course, you must remember that God isn't shaped like a person. People have skins, and there's always something outside our skins. If there wasn't, we wouldn't know the difference between what's inside and outside our bodies. But God has no skin and no shape, because there isn't any outside to him. The inside and the outside of God are the same. And though I have been talking about God as he and not she, God is not a man or a woman. I didn't say it, for you usually say it for things that aren't alive. God is the self of the world, but you can't see God for the same reason that without a mirror you can't see your own eyes, and you certainly can't bite your own teeth or look inside your own head. Your self is that cleverly hidden because it's God hiding. You may ask why God sometimes hides in the form of horrible people or pretends to be people who suffer great disease and pain. Remember first that he isn't really doing this to anyone but himself. Remember too that in almost all the stories you enjoy, there have to be bad people as well as good people. For the thrill of the tale is to find out how the good people will get the better of the bad. It's the same when we play cards. At the beginning of the game, we shuffle them all into a mess, which is like the bad things in the world. But the point of the game is to put the mess into good order. And the one who does it the best is the winner. Thus, we shuffle the cards once more and play again, and so it goes with the world. Here ends the second reading. Well, I'm very happy to bring you the greetings and good wishes of the two Unitarian congregations I'm a member of, Cambridge Unitarian Church and our congregation at Bury St. Edmunds. I was telling some people it's about 30 years, I think, since I last preached here in the time of the American woman minister, Cynthia Edson, I think she was called. And I keep up with you through your very impressive newsletter, which I'm always delighted and most interested to read. It's a great tribute to you, to your minister, Sarah, and to you. And very impressive record of what's going on here. I'm always delighted to receive it. Oh, would some power the gifty give us to see ourselves as others see us? Well, I think it was Robert Burns who wrote this immortal verse, and I wish I could truly imitate his Scots accent. I think I can make a good shot at Miss Jean Brodie, but so far I feel Robert Burns is beyond me, so please forgive my feeble attempt. To see ourselves as others see us, that may give us a nasty shock or a pleasant surprise. And often one way of seeing ourselves in a new light is to travel abroad. And we may well be astonished at what the natives will make of us. And that's one reason why I always enjoy visiting the United States. One of the interesting things about Americans is that many of them are ready to let you know their reaction to you even after a somewhat short acquaintance. The English are usually much more guarded and reticent. And this frank and open-hearted American approach can be bracing and even disconcerting. Well, I'm rather reminded of something that was said by the late Quentin Crisp, the celebrated eccentric, and it was about the difference between living in London and living in New York City. In London, he said, while your friends may be well aware that you have certain good qualities and some useful achievements to your name, they're never going to say anything about them to you, are they? That would run the risk of making you swell-headed. And they wouldn't want to encourage you to do that, would they? Might be encouraging you to be vain and arrogant, and that would never do, certainly not. On the other hand, they don't feel they need to refrain from telling you about your mistakes, your failings and your drawbacks. After all, they are keen to help you to improve, aren't they? And if they're quick to point out where you're going wrong, that will help you to put things right all the quicker, won't it? So that is life in London. But in New York, it's completely different. If you have some talent or ability, your American friends will be the first to recognize it and congratulate you on it. Not once, but again and again. They'll be ever so happy to go on telling you how wonderful you are. You're marvelous. You're wonderful. You're the greatest. You're the tops. So whereas in London, the air is full of criticism and rebuke, in New York, the air is full of praise and congratulation. People are delighted to tell you how marvellous you are, how much they admire you, what remarkable gifts you have. So New York is full of admiration, appreciation, encouragement. In New York, you are a star. Well, that's marvellous, isn't it? Why don't we all take the next plane to New York? Well, the only reason is, I think, that the expense of living in New York City would be even more than it is in London, so that would make it completely impossible. Perhaps if, when we win £100 million on the Euro Millions lottery, we may be able to go and live in New York. Anyway, that was Quentin Crisp's experience. London, cold and critical, New York, warm and encouraging. Well, I've had two experiences of my own, not in New York, but in America, that tend to support something of what he says. But before I say that, I must tell you something that Quentin Crisp once said, something very interesting about Unitarians in America. You may not have heard it. He said, "My advice to a young gay man who feels anxious and fearful about going to live in an as yet unknown American city and is troubled about how he may be treated there is this. Seek out the nearest Unitarian church, for there you will find sympathy, understanding, acceptance, encouragement, protection and friendship." Well, I always think that's what a remarkable tribute from a completely unexpected source that is. Anyway, here are two of my experiences in America, which confirms something of what he says. I was once boarding the bus in New Bedford, Massachusetts, that famous whaling capital of the 19th century on the Atlantic coast. And there was a charming young black woman on the bus, and she greeted me with the most dazzling, marvellous smile. It was entirely friendly. There was not the least trace of mockery, not the slightest suggestion of a sneer in it. It was wonderfully warm, generous, well, genuinely welcoming. Her beautiful, smiling face was the very image of generous, hospitable America greeting everyone as friend. You know, she could have replaced the Statue of Liberty with a wonderful smile. "Bring me your tired and huddled masses yearning to live free." Well, to be the cause of such a lovely, exuberant smile can be very flattering, of course. Now, at first I wonder, well, is she smiling at me? And I look round, but there's nobody behind me. So she must have been smiling at me. But why should I be the one in particular to receive this? I was puzzled. I didn't know until she spoke. And then she said, "Has anyone ever told you that you look just like Mickey Rooney?" "Well, no, actually, they haven't," I replied. "Well, you do," she said. "You're the spitting image." "Well, how kind of you to let me know," I said, "because I'm sure you mean it as a compliment. And I wouldn't mind his bank balance either." "Well, there is that too," she said. "We never know. You may be lucky." Well, later, I did see some pictures of Mr. Rooney. I can't say I felt flattered, but I could see what she meant, alas. Well, later, I had another interesting encounter. Whenever I'm in the neighbourhood of Boston, I very much enjoy being invited to preach at King's Chapel. Well, many of you will know what this lovely church is. It's a lovely 17th century building in the style of Christopher Wren, and it is a unique place. It is, in fact, the oldest Anglican church in Boston, which at the time of American independence, more or less the same time that this congregation started in Essex Street in the Strand, it became a Unitarian congregation. The rector fled and the congregation ordained a young man, James Ree Freeman, to be their minister, and they revised the Book of Common Prayer in a Unitarian direction. And they still have that revised book. And they've retained forever their revised edition of the Anglican Book of Common Prayer. And they also pay their visiting ministers a generous fee, which is very useful when you're a poor English parson in Massachusetts. The attractions of King's Chapel are not purely historical. Well, one Sunday I had the honour of preaching in this beautiful old church, and naturally I went on to the coffee hour afterwards. Their parish house is a lovely 18th century building on Beacon Hill, looking onto Boston Common. And while I was drinking my coffee, a woman journalist marched up to me, ever so enthusiastic and animated. "Oh, you remind me so much of Richard Burton," she exclaimed. Well, I almost dropped my cup of coffee, but I did have the presence of mind to make an inquiry. "Do you mean the Victorian explorer and translator of the Arabian Nights," I said, "or the Welsh actor?" "I mean the film star married to Elizabeth Taylor," she said. Well, I almost collapsed with a fit of laughter into the Aubusson carpet. To see ourselves as others see us, I have not been in the habit of seeing myself as Richard Burton. And when I came to think about it, I wondered whether I should feel so very flattered. The late Richard Burton had an unfortunate pockmarked face, much disfigured in later years by alcoholism. Was I reminding people of that? Nor did I think that in our marital relationships, Richard Burton and I had very much in common. The only thing that we were being compared for that I could think of was our histrionic ability. It may well be that we are both of us outrageous ham actors. That thought was not entirely displeasing, so all in all I felt flattered, though astonished, by the way this American woman journalist saw me. So there it is, two experiences. Perhaps they could only happen in America. In England, I'm well aware that I appear, as a kind London friend once told me, she said, "Do you realise how insignificant you look?" I said, "Well, that's all right. That's why I dress up like this, you see, is to make myself look less insignificant." And also, I'm doing it today in honour of Theophilus Lindsay, the first minister of this congregation. In England, I'm well aware I appear blessedly insignificant, I don't complain. To pass as incognito can be harmless and agreeable. But in America, it seems, things are very different. There I'm seen as a clapped-out child comedian, or as an alcoholic, much-divorced Welsh actor. And the only consolation, I suppose, is that in each case, I am seen as a star. Well, to see ourselves as others see us. Indeed, we may be in for a shock. Over the entrance to the Delphic Oracle in ancient Greece were the words, "Gnothis eauton noskis teipsum," in English, "know thyself." A very ancient command that is still as powerful and relevant as ever. Not, I hasten to add, as an invitation to narcissistic self-preoccupation, but as something much more profound. Know thyself. But which is my true self, the Richard Burton-like figure or the Mickey Rooney look-alike? We are many selves, of course. Human beings are very complex creatures, as our reading from St. Paul made very clear. You may remember the late Evelyn Waugh. He was supremely gifted as a novelist and writer, but far from admirable as a person. He was intolerably snobbish and liked to think of himself as one of the Catholic aristocracy. In fact, his origins were utterly middle class, and indeed, amongst his ancestors were several eminent Unitarians, in particular, members of the brilliantly talented artistic and scientific family, the De Morgans. And I like to think this is where some of his talents came from. He used to play the most odious practical jokes and cruel practical jokes on innocent people and was often most disagreeable and unpleasant. And yet, when Monsignor Ronald Knox lay dying of cancer, Evelyn Waugh gave up everything for many months to attend to Father Knox's needs during his final illness. That was rather a saintly thing to do. My wife used to say, "Well, he did it because it was Monsignor Ronald Knox, and he wouldn't have done it for anybody else." No doubt that is true. All the same, he did it. And when we remember Evelyn Waugh's disagreeable side, we ought to remember, too, how he nursed Ronald Knox so devotedly. Well, I can't resist telling one story about Evelyn Waugh at his worst. It concerns the wonderful day when bananas returned to England. During the war, they were completely unobtainable, of course. At Christmas, we used to get rations of oranges and so on, but the popular song of the day was completely accurate. Yes, we have no bananas. It parodied the way some shopkeepers took a malicious delight in being negative. We have no bananas today. Children had heard of bananas, and if they were old enough, they might even dimly remember them, but they had the magical glamour of utterly obtainable fruit. The nearest we could come to them were some special kinds of sweets that were said to taste rather like bananas. Anyway, after the war, there came a blessed day when bananas returned. They were strictly rationed still, of course. Evelyn Waugh was a devout Catholic convert who did not believe in birth control and had a large family of at least 7 children. The family's ration of bananas was reverently carried into the dining room of the Waugh mansion. 7 bananas. The children's eyes shone with excitement. Their tummies rumbled in anticipation. Heartlessly, greedily, selfishly, with sadistic cruelty, Evelyn Waugh ate every one of those bananas himself, while his children's mouths watered and they gazed on him, hardly believing their eyes. And his eldest son has said that never afterwards could he look on his father quite in the same way. Well, know thyself, which was the real Evelyn Waugh? The cruel, greedy man who did sadistically taunted his children by eating their precious bananas, or the saintly figure tending Ruddle Knox in his last illness? The answer is he was both. We have all of us a collection of better selves and worse selves within us. But can we know ourselves in some profounder sense than this? Give ourselves a sense of unity. Know ourselves in a way that will give us encouragement and even possibly serenity. Well, there was a famous popular writer on religion who became a guru to young people in the 60s. I am referring, of course, to the late Alan Watts. He was himself, in many ways, a highly mixed-up person. He was brought up as a devout Anglican in Canterbury, in England, in the very heart of the cathedral establishment. But as a boy, he bravely rebelled and became a Buddhist. And while very young, he wrote a book on the subject. He married a wealthy American girl and went back with her to Chicago, where he became ordained as an Episcopalian priest, that is, Church of England in America. He managed to keep this up for as long as 6 years. And then he became his own variety of Buddhist once again, marrying and divorcing many times and maintaining himself as a teacher and writer on religion, particularly Asian religion. He published a stream of books and articles which were very clearly and persuasively written, presenting ancient religious teachings in a very fresh, attractive and even startling way. He lived on a houseboat in San Francisco Bay, just across from the Golden Gate Bridge, and in the shadow of Mount Tamalpais, the sacred mountain of the Indians. He became more and more of a hippie, which was all right, but also he became more and more of an alcoholic, which was very sad. All the same, he had an extraordinary ability to give marvellous talks and lectures and television appearances while being quite drunk. He said he didn't like himself unless he'd drunk a bottle of vodka, so he started drinking a bottle of vodka every day and died at the early age of 57. Well, all the same, I don't think that his regrettable lifestyle means that his books were no good. I still think that his insights are genuine and important. And one of the most interesting books he wrote had the intriguing title, The Book on the Taboo Against Knowing Who You Are, from which we read this morning. He maintains that we are all engaged in a tacit conspiracy to ignore who or what we really are. There's a taboo, he says, which is preventing people from realizing their heritage. In Western civilization, we think of ourselves as separate selves, separate egos in bags of skin, which make us quite distinct and separate. This, he says, is a hallucination. We have become obsessed with the idea that we are neatly sealed units, alienated from life, from the world, from one another. We feel very insecure and vulnerable, each of us in our separate bags of skin. And frantically, we feel we must protect ourselves, and that's why we become so selfish, so desperate for money and things, to such an extent that we are willing to destroy our natural environment to get them. And that is why we are afraid of life and death, and why so many people have wanted religion to assure them that their own particular separate identity will go on forever and ever. Our whole society brainwashes us into believing that we are separate entities, independent of our environment. We talk about the conquest of nature as if we ourselves were not part of nature, but some separate agency confronting it and in conflict with it, the object being to overcome it. No wonder we often have no respect for our natural environment, because we are alienated from it, feel ourselves superior to it. There is a way out of this predicament, said Alan Watts. First, we must break through the taboo against knowing who we are. Know thyself, in fact. Give up the idea that we've come into the world from outside. Realize instead that we have emerged from it, grown out of it. Just as individual leaves emerge from the tree, so our lives have emerged from the world. In just the same way as the ocean waves, the universe peoples. And this is what Adam Watts says. Every individual is an expression of the whole realm of nature, a unique action of the total universe. This fact is rarely, if ever, experienced by most individuals. Even those who know it to be true in theory do not sense it or feel it, but continue to be aware of themselves as isolated egos inside bags of skin. Well, coming from Alan Watts, I find those words very poignant. That, I'm sure, was exactly his own position. He knew it intellectually, but he couldn't feel it. And that may have been one of the reasons that drove him to drink. Because when he was drunk, he might feel less insulated, less cut off from the rest of life. Know thyself. Who are we? We are focal points at which the whole universe expresses itself. This view is expressed in the great Indian religious classic, the Bhagavad Gita, the Song of God. I am the self that dwells at the heart of every mortal creature. We are all of us particular expressions of the energy that is the whole universe. That is why we can sense a sacredness in people and even in things, and realizing it may help to dispel our anxiety about our fate and our survival. But one last story. A few years ago, a friendly nun, a Buddhist nun, the Venerable Sikhe Yeshe Zangmo, visited our Unitarian Church in Cambridge and gave an address there. Well, despite her name, she is completely English, born and brought up in Peterborough, where her father was serving in the Royal Air Force. Very strangely, even though there were no Buddhists in her family, from an early age she conceived an ambition to be a Buddhist nun. And even more remarkably, she eventually became one. Well, I shall always remember the parable she told us. I call it the parable of the light bulbs. She said that we as individuals are rather like individual light bulbs. Of course, we differ greatly in the amount of light we can give out. Some remarkable people can radiate tremendous light, several hundred watts. Most of us may be pretty average light bulbs of 60 watts or so, and no doubt there are many light bulbs winking along at 40 watts or fewer. No matter. When we are connected and switched on, the electric current flows through us and we radiate the light. Some 20-fold, some 60-fold, some 100-fold, and a very few 500-fold and more. But it is the same electric energy that is pouring itself into us and expressing itself through our particular bulb. We are that energy, vehicles for that energy. In course of time, the bulb wears out or is accidentally smashed. It can no longer radiate the light. It has to be disconnected and disposed of. But the energy that flowed through it has not perished. It's always there, waiting to express itself in a new bulb or in any vehicle that can serve its purpose. While we were connected, our particular light bulb was channeling this energy and expressing it. At our heart, so to speak, we were this energy. The electric bulb wears out, but the electrical energy does not. It's there, the very same energy expressing itself in a new way, a myriad new ways. Well, a very suggestive parable, don't you think? And a very encouraging and hopeful parable. Know thyself, and our self is the total field of energy that is expressing itself through us. So, know thyself indeed, not as a limited, fragile, separate thing, but as part of the whole energy that is flowing. The psalmist said, I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Thou knowest me altogether. And the best comment on the parable of the light bulbs may well be the saying of Jesus, you are the light of the world. Let your light shine. Amen.
And so, may love keep us and bless us in the week ahead. Accepting of ourselves, accepting of others, playing our game in that great mystery that is life itself. Amen. Go well and blessed be.